Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
Let's start this hour with reaction to President Obama's speech last night.
A lot of questions remain about the threat ISIS poses to the U.S. and whether the president needs more authorization from Congress to do what he wants to do. In a moment, we'll hear from Republican Congressman Mike Turner. But first, we are joined by Ben Rhodes, the White House Deputy National Security Advisor. Ben Rhodes, welcome to Here and Now.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, does the president have the authority already, in your view, to carry out this campaign against ISIS without another vote of authorization in Congress?
Yes, Jeremy. We believe that the president has the constitutional authority to carry out these actions against ISIL. We believe that based on the 2001 AUMF and his constitutional powers, he can carry out strikes against an organization like ISIL that is an outgrowth of al-Qaeda that poses a direct threat to American personnel and to U.S. interests. We've also said that we'd welcome congressional support for these actions. As the president said last night, we're stronger as a country when we act together. But he is currently taking action under his authorities and will continue to do so.
But the 2001 AUMF, which is the authorization for the use of military force against terrorists, is, and I'm quoting here, to authorize the U.S. armed forces against those responsible for the recent attacks launched against the United States. We're talking about September 11th, 2001. But ISIS didn't have anything to do with those attacks.
They were an outgrowth of al-Qaeda in Iraq, AQI as we used to call it, which was the principal al-Qaeda affiliate in Iraq. They, of course, have since had differences with al-Qaeda and have established themselves as their own entity. I'd also note that the president has authority as commander-in-chief to take action to protect American personnel and facilities. We have been doing that in Iraq, given the threat to our people in Baghdad and Erbil. We've been filing war powers reports that is part of his constitutional requirements, again, with those actions, and will continue to do so going forward. So there are a range of different authorities that the president has, but we certainly do keep Congress informed through war powers reports and consultations, and we'll be discussing with Congress what additional things they can do to support our actions against ISIL.
But even if ISIL was an outgrowth of al-Qaeda, this clearly wasn't the intention of the 2001 AUMF to go fighting any outgrowth of al-Qaeda. It says specifically those responsible for the recent attacks.
Well, again, that's right, but it identifies the ability to take action going forward against al-Qaeda, and we have used that authority to go after associated forces of al-Qaeda. That would include, for instance, al-Shabaab in Somalia, AQAP, the affiliate in Yemen. But to your point, Jeremy, the president said in his speech at NDU over a year ago that as al-Qaeda core is diminished and as the circumstances that led to 9/11 have changed, we do need to look at whether we need to ultimately repeal that 2001 AUMF and replace it with a different authorization.
There are also big questions about how serious a threat ISIS actually poses to the United States. The Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson said yesterday, at present we have no credible information that ISIS is planning to attack the homeland of the U.S. And the president emphasized that point in his speech also. So why does the U.S. have such an interest in going after this group?
Well, there are several reasons, Jeremy. First of all, we've been taking action on an urgent basis in Iraq to protect our personnel and facilities. Clearly, if they were to come into a population center like Erbil, where we have diplomats serving and we have military personnel serving, those people would be put at risk. And we need not look any further than the horrifying killings of two American journalists to know that any American is in danger if they're in proximity to ISIL. Beyond that, there is not specific plotting detected against the homeland yet, but we have threats from ISIL leaders against the United States and our allies, and we know that there are foreign fighters who are fighting with ISIL in Iraq and Syria, thousands of them, including many Europeans who can travel to the United States more easily, including Americans as well. So this could develop into a more direct threat against the homeland or America's allies in Europe, on a quicker basis, given those foreign fighters. The last thing I'd say is ISIL was risking overrunning a large swaths of Iraq and Syria. That could essentially pose a threat to the government of Iraq, pose a threat to other U.S. partners in the region. So clearly this is a threat that we felt had to be dealt with.
But what about Syria? We don't have diplomats in Syria that we need to protect.
No, we don't. And so what we have is a safe haven where the border between Iraq and Syria has essentially disappeared. If we're going to deal with the challenge posed by ISIL, we need to deal with a safe haven on both sides of that border. We are committing to use airstrikes to do that. However, the partners who are fighting on the ground are not going to be American forces. We're strengthening the Iraqi security forces and the Kurdish forces on the Iraqi side of the border, and we want to continue to help strengthen the Syrian opposition on the Syrian side of the border so that there is an alternative to ISIL.
You bring up partners, and I want to ask you about this broad coalition that the president talked about. We're hearing today that Germany and the United Kingdom won't be part of airstrikes. So who's in this coalition?
Well, so first of all, we expect there to be many countries who participate in this effort. That includes key Arab partners like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, many of our European allies and NATO allies, countries like Australia and Canada. At the same time, not every country in this coalition will need to conduct airstrikes to be a part of this effort. There are many ways that countries can contribute. Even in Iraq, what we've seen is countries flying humanitarian airdrops with us, countries committing intelligence resources to this effort. Countries have been providing arms and training to Iraqi and Kurdish forces. So, for instance, you mentioned Germany. They have provided arms to the Kurdish forces. That's critically important. The airstrikes are only one component of a broader campaign. At the end of the day, the people who are going to be the most invested in this are the Iraqis who are fighting the threat on the ground.
Ben Rhodes, White House Deputy National Security Advisor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, Republicans are responding to the president's plan. Today, House Speaker John Boehner said he supports the plan to arm and train Syrian rebels, but he still has concerns.
If our goal is to eliminate ISIL, there's a lot of doubt whether the plan that was outlined by the president last night is enough to accomplish that mission.
Ohio Congressman Mike Turner sits on the House Armed Services Committee. He joins us now from Capitol Hill. And Congressman, you recently said you needed to see a coordinated plan.
Well, and members of Congress, including myself, have been saying this for some time. As you look to the issue of Iraq, you know, the president in his Cairo speech said that he had basically a three-point plan, and that was he was going to remove American troops, support Iraq and its democratic institutions, its sovereign integrity, and also hold Islamic extremists at bay. The president withdrew our troops, but then basically walked away, allowing a situation to unfold where Iraq had become destabilized. And with the brewing situation in Syria, again, another situation that the president had walked away from, you know, we saw Iraq be invaded and now being occupied by ISIS. Now, the president last night began to make the case and to I think, identify ISIS as a threat to our national security. And in that, now believes that he should mobilize our military and take action. Haphazard military airstrikes are not going to accomplish this. A coordinated plan is something that the military needs to put together. I think as a commander-in-chief, he has now empowered them to do so. But we need to see that the president is going to follow through and that there are not going to be limitations on the actions that the military bring forward. I mean, what we had the president state was strong words, but now he has to follow through. What we saw in Libya was the president, in removing Gaddafi, had no post-Gaddafi regime plan. Similarly, in Libya, you now see chaos. And what we want to see is that the president has the ability and the commitment to follow through.
So start with the airstrikes. Are you for the airstrikes?
Well, I believe that he needs to rely on our military to tell them what needs to be done to defeat ISIS. I am for defeating ISIS. I'm certain that airstrikes are going to have to be a portion of the coordinated plan. So if you're asking, you know, would I oppose airstrikes? No.
It sounded like you're saying you want there to be more choices for military reaction to ISIS. Are you aligning with fellow Republicans like Lindsey Graham, who does want combat boots on the ground? John McCain has been calling for more action than even airstrikes. Would you be okay with U.S. troops responding to ISIS?
I mean, the issue really is, which is, I think, what the president needs to do, is to depend on his military advisors. I'm not a military advisor, and so I'm not, like McCain or others, one who feels, that I have the expertise to be able to tell the president what his military plan should be.
Well, as a member of Congress, you may have to vote on this. We're hearing that there are already surveillance planes in Syria ahead of strikes there. The president's plan would both support and undermine Assad's regime in Syria. The strikes would disable ISIS. ISIS has fought Assad. But the president is also proposing more support for the moderate rebel group fighting Assad. Given how complicated that is, what direct questions would you have for the president?
Well, I think it's certainly going to be imperative that the president describe who we're for and who we're supporting. Before, both with when the issue of Syria came up, the president made it unclear as to who we were supporting. But basically, the president has some really bad choices here, and he has bad choices because he's allowed this issue to continue to degrade.
Is that fair? You've said that a number of times. And last year, you were one of the voices against airstrikes against Syria when President Assad used chemical weapons against his own people.
Well, what the president proposed then, which is what I was against, was taking action to attack Syria and their, as he stated, their capability of weapons of mass destruction. It was unclear then how the president was going to accomplish that, and it looked as if that could actually create a more dangerous situation than we were currently facing. And as we know, the president ultimately did negotiate a deal that resulted in the chemical weapons being removed.
And some say
but
that
the
that
president, after that, did nothing else. He didn't look at the issue of how do we address the emerging threats in Syria or the actions the Assad regime was taking against its own people.
Ohio Republican Congressman Mike Turner, a member of the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman, thank you.
Thank you.
And as we said, Republicans were not unified in their reaction to Syria in the past, and Republicans aren't today on the ISIS crisis there. Congressman Turner just said he would be for airstrikes. But last night, Senator Rand Paul told Fox News after the president's speech that the president's plan is unconstitutional, and he should have asked Congress for an up or down vote on authorizing war. We'll continue to gather opinion. Meanwhile, what is yours? Let us know at hereandnow.org. You can also tweet us at hereandnowrobin, at Jeremy Hobson. The sounds of a humpback whale. The ability to eavesdrop on them is just one feature of a new app that's being rolled out today, created by a consortium of marine conservationists. It's the first ever national application to save whales from ship strikes. To explain, we have Vicky Croak, who reports on the animal world for Here and Now. Vicky, tell us about the app Whale Alert.
Basically, the app is designed to track whales and to keep them safe. For the most part, that means preventing one of the leading causes of whale mortality, which is ship strikes. But it's also a crowdsourcing app, and it lets all of us get into the act, sighting and identifying whales. And that means it blends several high-tech elements. It's like an air traffic control tower mixed with GPS driving directions, mixed with a social networking site. Nautical charts with real-time data, as they say, so that when boaters see a whale out in the water, they can report the sighting and pinpoint that very spot. And for pilots on those big cruiser container ships, those are the troublesome ones for whales, it's got lots of features to help them avoid the whales. And Patrick Ramage, who's the director of the Global Whale Program at the International Fund for Animal Welfare, and that's one of the groups that helped create the app, explained that to me. So let's have a listen.
What Whale Alert does is enables the mariner to have a real-time heads-up display of the presence of whales that have been sighted in the area, immediate one-stop-shop access to the various regulatory measures that are in place with which they need to comply. It consolidates various sources of incoming information that have been bombarding the mariner as he's trying to safely navigate the vessel into a single application.
So a ship's pilot can see if a whale's nearby, know if the ship is in a whale management area, and then find a recommended route. But what about those of us just standing on the beach?
So, Robin, if you're standing on Cape Cod and you see a whale, you can enter the information, including a picture. They've got a whale ID guide that helps you to classify what kind of whale you saw. And then Your sighting gets added to the database, helping everyone else in the area know where that whale is.
But here comes the best part. Whales themselves can put information in?
So here off the coast of Massachusetts, in that huge federally protected marine sanctuary called Stellwagen Bank, there are 12 acoustic buoys set up. And when a right whale vocalizes near one of them, that sound gets detected by the buoys. And Patrick Ramage again explained how this works.
There's an algorithm that has been developed that can detect a right whale up call. It sounds something like this. When that sound is picked up by these acoustic buoys, they automatically trigger a report that is validated by the federal government and integrated into the Whale Alerts application.
So it's sort of like Facebook for whales.
That's right, or fluke book, as I like to call it. But, you know, for whales who are closer to shore, that often means that they're feeding.
Which is fun. But how effective is it in preventing these injuries?
In recent years, ship strikes on North Atlantic right whales have been reduced. And that's due not just to the app, but to a number of factors, including slowing ships down in key areas. And they're highly, highly endangered animals. It's estimated that there are only about 450 individuals left in the world. That's a tiny population. And for this species, ship strikes are the number one mortality factor.
Well, so we want to protect the right whales, but there are all sorts of whales on the West Coast as well. Will this apply to them?
Yes, absolutely. So this now can benefit humpback and sperm whales, blue whales, gray whales, fin whales, and many others. And the people in the consortium making this app are really excited. They say they're seeing the future, and they're calling it 21st century conservation. And they think the potential is limitless. Certainly, they've got their eye on making this global.
Vicky Krogh, Here and Now animal reporter. She also writes the wildlife blog for our mothership, WBUR. We'll link you to it. Vicky, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, now to Cleveland, where one of the country's most prestigious, though little-known, literary awards is being presented tonight. For nearly eight decades, the Annisfield Wolf Award has honored some of America's top writers for their contributions to understanding racism and appreciating diversity. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WCPN's David C. Barnett has more.
Indiana poet Adrian Matika embodies America's diversity. His birth father was black, his mother is white. There is some Native American in his family tree, and his stepfather is Polish.
My last name throws everything off. It's hard to spell, it's hard to place, and then when you see me, it's even more complicated.
The complicated story of race and identity in this country is explored in Matika's most recent book, The Big Smoke, a collection of 52 poems about Jack Johnson, the first African-American heavyweight boxing champion. Matika was out to correct what he sees as the inaccuracies of how Johnson has been previously portrayed, especially in the stage and film productions of The Great White Hope.
Jack Johnson would quote poetry. You know, he would recite Shakespeare. He trained himself classically on the viol. He would do all of these things that he imagined a gentleman was supposed to do. But none of that appears in The Great White Hope. It's just like this kind of country black guy who's got a thing for white women and can box.
The Big Smoke didn't win the National Book Award or the Pulitzer Prize, but it did win an equally distinguished literary honor, the Annisfield Wolf Book Award. In 1934, Cleveland poet and philanthropist Edith Annisfield Wolf established an annual book award in her father's name that honored works devoted to the subject of racial relations. Now, this was nearly 30 years before Martin Luther King Jr. made his I Have a Dream speech. In fact, King was a recipient of the Annisfield Wolf Prize in 1959, 4 years before he rose to national prominence. Speaking at last year's awards ceremony, Annisfield Wolf jury chair Henry Louis Gates reflected on the award's unlikely roots.
You know, every time I think about this prize, I think how anomalous. A poet in the 1930s, who happened to be a white woman, endows one of the first, certainly, if not the first, prizes in celebration of what today we would call excellence and diversity.
Gates went on to note that over the course of 80 years, the roster of winners reads like a who's who of African-American writers, from Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes to Toni Morrison and August Wilson.
So many black people won it that it used to be nicknamed the Black Pulitzer Prize, at least uptown.
In more recent years, the award has expanded from race relations in the U.S. to global issues of cultural diversity. One of this year's Lifetime Achievement honorees is 93-year-old Sir Wilson Harris, a native of Guyana, whose fiction uses a dense, almost mystical writing style to explore the subtleties of racism.
Some oppression is subtle. Some oppression is dominant. There is a mystery to freedom. There's a mystery to truth. There's a mystery to knowledge. And one has to pursue this all the time with an awareness that what one is getting at can never be absolutely defined.
And while grateful to be honored, Harris admits he had never heard of this award. That's an issue that the Annisfield Wolf Prize has struggled with for years. Although the Cleveland Award matches the $10,000 given to winners of the New York-based National Book Award and the Pulitzers, those East Coast honors seem to get all the press. But Adrian Matika says he'll take the long history of Annisfield Wolf over the buzz of the Big Apple.
Yeah, I have several of the winners on my shelves. So I had them on my shelves mostly before they'd won it. And I never thought that I had a chance to win it. And so now I'm still doing cartwheels about that.
Adrian Matika, Wilson Harris, and three others will join an eight-decade roster of winners of the Annisfield Wolf Book Award tonight in Cleveland. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett.
A stunning headline out of Scotland today. The Royal Bank of Scotland says it will move its headquarters to England if Scots vote for independence from the UK next week. This was after Lloyds Banking Group said it would do the same thing. This is big. RBS, the Royal Bank of Scotland, has been based in Scotland since 1727. Derek Thompson of The Atlantic joins us. And remind us, Derek, why Scotland's two largest banks would consider leaving the country.
It's called the Royal Bank of Scotland, but technically it's more like the Public Bank of England. The bank is 80% owned by UK taxpayers, and most of those taxpayers live in England. Its bank of last resort is the Bank of England. And so for all of these reasons, there is a lot of concerns about what happens exactly if Scotland does, on September 18th in this referendum, vote for independence and peel Scotland away from the rest of the UK. Well, so for this reason, the bank essentially said in a note that if Scotland does vote to become an independent country, they will essentially reincorporate in the UK.
Well, both Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds received huge bailouts from the British government in 2008 and 2009, as you alluded to. And, you know, you wonder if there's pressure to keep the banks as a part of the UK in England if Scotland votes for independence because of that big investment. What have we heard from the Bank of England on this?
There's just a lot of, I think, uncertainty. And the thing that investors hate in the financial world is uncertainty. We haven't even made a decision about what currency Scotland might use if it goes independent. They could use the sterling. They could use a different currency. But, you know, currently they're backed by an old and established sterling that the rest of the world has faith in. And so there's just a lot of concerns about this bank's credit rating if it suddenly becomes part of a newly minted, unrated sovereign of Scotland. And so I think essentially one of the big reasons why Lloyds and RBS are essentially threatening even to reincorporate or move their legal status to the UK is that they want to mitigate this risk. They want investors to understand that the bank will change as little as possible. And I think they also possibly might want to scare voters to say, don't change a major part of this area's economy.
Yeah, well, there are other messages coming out. Lloyds, for instance, warning that mortgage lenders are preparing to restrict lending in the event of a yes vote. What else will this mean for Scotland's economy if not just these two banks depart, but others follow?
One in eight jobs right now are in financial services in Scotland, in Edinburgh and Glasgow in particular. RBS employs about 11,000 people in Scotland. Lloyds has about 16,000. There's been a lot of criticism of this move, a lot of concern about this move because people are afraid about jobs. And to their credit, both banks have said that we don't expect to move a lot of jobs. We expect essentially to reincorporate in the UK to make sure that we can still count on the Bank of England to backstop us, to essentially act as a lender of last resort. But still, it's is caused a lot of sort of frothy concern about what exactly happens to this major keystone of our economy if essentially we break off from the rest of the UK.
Well, Derek, in the few seconds we have, this comes right after a very brand new poll showed Scotland's voters are leaning towards independence. You think this was a scare tactic?
I think it was a little bit of two things. I think one audience was the voters in the referendum to say, please think twice before asking for independence, even if we do have a lot of oil up here, and also to speak to investors to say, please calm down, don't short sell us simply because you're confused about this vote.
It's fascinating. Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Gary Eugene Bird.
Joshua David Birnbaum.
George John Bishop.
Chris Romeo Bishundat.
Family members today reading the names of loved ones who died in the 9/11 terrorist attacks at the World Trade Center 13 years ago today. There were also many people who were injured in the attacks and others, including first responders who later developed debilitating physical and mental health illnesses, including chronic respiratory disease, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and a variety of cancers, some of which are just beginning to develop. Dr. Benjamin Luft is the director of the World Trade Center Health Program at Stony Brook Medicine. He's been following the health of some 6,000 9/11 responders since 2001, and he's with us now. Dr. Luft, welcome.
A pleasure to be here.
Well, 13 years after the 9/11 attacks, what are the biggest medical challenges that you see first responders facing?
Well, the biggest challenges that are facing responders is that their diseases and problems continue to linger, and not only linger, but are becoming worse and worse. So the psychiatric problems, the respiratory problems, they didn't just get better, but they're actually getting worse and progressing. And I think that that's causing the greatest amount of dysfunction in this population.
Well, I'm glad you brought up psychiatric problems because we just spoke with John Feel on the program yesterday. He's a first responder who has suffered some health problems. And he thinks that PTSD, which he has suffered from, is the number one killer of 9/11 first responders.
Absolutely. The impact of PTSD is so variable. Not only does it impact one psychologically, but impacts their daily life, their ability to go outside and interact with other people. And then finally, it impacts their physical disease. It actually worsens the physical problems, and it makes those physical problems less able to be treated by normal medical therapy. What we're finding is that those patients who have that combination of the psychological problem, PTSD, and the respiratory disease, that those people tend to be more recalcitrant to therapy. They don't respond to therapy like everybody else. And as a result of that, they have a lot of other issues that come to bear.
Do you have any sense of why that is?
Well, what we believe is that the psychiatric problem itself basically primes the immune system to become much more inflammatory. And as a result of that, they're much more likely to have respiratory problems that impact both their functional ability as well as their social capacity.
You were involved in a study last year examining the incidence of cancer in responders during the first 7 years after 9/11, 2001 to 2008. And your study found that the risks of cancer in first responders were much higher than the general public. Tell us more about that study.
What happened with the World Trade Center responder was that they went down, a lot of them voluntarily, to the World Trade Center site. They were told that the environment was safe, that there was no real risk in terms of toxins. The air was clear. They were not given the appropriate protective equipment. And then what was found subsequently was that the exact opposite occurred, that the environment was full of various carcinogens and toxins. And so you had these people who went down there. They were put into the middle of an area that was full of toxins, and that because we know the natural history of that type of exposure, that we could predict in the future that they were going to develop a variety of cancers. Right now, the timeline is very short still. Cancers usually take many years to develop, and it takes a long time to accumulate the number of cases that you can statistically say that there is a larger than expected number of cases. But one thing for absolutely sure is that these responders went down there. They volunteered. The environment was unsafe. It was full of carcinogens. And our expectation is that they're going to suffer as a result of that.
And that makes it much more difficult to get compensation, doesn't it, if the illness doesn't develop for a long time after exposure?
Well, I think the decision was made that at least we would be able to provide care for these responders who developed cancer. And I think that that was the appropriate decision that was made. It really does very little good to a person after they're dead to tell them they're going to be compensated.
But if they don't get sick until, let's say, next year or the year after that, is it easy for them to apply and get the kind of care and compensation that they need from the government?
Yes, because the current Zadroga Act and the determination by the administrator at NIOSH was that cancer was to be covered because of the high expectation that cancers were going to develop in this population. So these are covered conditions.
But the Zadroga Act expires in 2015, doesn't it?
Yes. And that is something that we all have to be aware of, and we have to keep our eye on the ball. Because if once that expires, these people will be left high and dry.
Now, when we talk about these people and we think about 9/11 first responders in the abstract, it's hard to understand exactly what they're going through. Could you just give us a story? Because I know you've met and worked with a lot of these people about what one case is and what that person has gone through over these 13 years.
One of the cases that I just remember so vividly was a patient who was born in Guyana. And he recollects when he was a young boy and his family was literally starving that he used to receive care packages from the United States. And when 9/11 occurred, he was a construction worker. He was the head of a crew. He went right down there. And he was severely affected. He developed severe asthma, severe post-traumatic stress disorder, and his life was really turned upside down. But when I said to him, "Would you do it again?" he looked at me, he said, "Doc, this country has done so much for me. It saved my life. I would do it again in a snap." And I think that that really tells you something about the responders who went down there, their courage, their altruism, their selflessness. And it's for that reason that we really need to care for these type of people. We owe it to them.
Dr. Benjamin Luff directs the World Trade Center Health Program at Stony Brook University. Dr. Luff, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
Well, let's get to a late summer edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Ann Litt of KCRW in Los Angeles is with us now. Ann, welcome.
Thank you.
And with the summer ending, you actually have some music that you've been listening to that may keep the summer alive for some of us a little bit longer, starting with the song Pilgrim by the English artist Fink.
Come a long way, come a long way, come a long way, not to work it out.
So this is a summer song because?
Well, it's a summer song because I feel like it's a song that has inspired me this summer. I think the message of the song, and I don't know what was in Fink's mind when he wrote it, but from small beginnings come big endings, I think is something really good to remember and really, really keeps me centered and grounded. And so as far as a summer song goes, it's not a, you know, surfboard on the ocean kind of song, but it's a really powerful inside your heart song.
And tell us about Fink.
Well, Fink is from the UK, and on this album, what I love about it, it's more of a collaboration. It's been more of a band project, and I just find every song on this album breathtaking. And I'm not sure if it's because he's working with a full band this time in a new way, or if it's just because of the poetry coming out of him, because I think when he has lines like "From small beginnings come big endings," I think there's a power to this album that is greater than the ones he's had before.
Well, next let's hear from the American jazz and hip-hop artist Jose James. This is the song "While You Were Sleeping."
Never thought that she would go. Never thought that she would go.
Love that, and I love the sounds in the background. It's reminding me of Subterranean Homesick Alien from Radiohead.
Oh, great one. I think you're right on it with that. Well, he's rooted in the earth, just like that Radiohead song is. And, you know, you introduced him as jazz and hip-hop. And I think what's interesting to me about this new album and this song in particular, he's also calling on psychedelics and folk and rock in a new way for him. Also, what I love about this song, "While You Were Sleeping," is, like the song by Fink, there's a quiet, dark elegance about it. It's so sad. The love affair is over, is what he's talking about. And again, not necessarily a kickback on the beach song, but an album that's full of power, and he's singing from his soul, and I really believe him, and I take the journey with him, and it's kind of heartbreaking at the same time.
You're making me think about summer in a whole new way.
That was my intention.
Okay, well, let's get to the group Noah and the Megafauna. Here is the song "Fanfare for," and I'm not even sure how to pronounce this word, A-E-O-M-A-M-E.
Well, you know what? You're in luck, Jeremy, because they just changed the name of the song yesterday to "Fanfare."
Why? Why is that?
Well, actually, I've been playing this song a lot on the air at KCRW, and I actually called the band out on Sunday when I played it and said, can somebody tell Noah and the Megafauna to call me and tell me how to pronounce this? Because I'm at a loss. I'm butchering this. I play it all the time. I love this song. And I got an email from the main guy in Noah and the Megafauna yesterday who told me, in my honor, they changed the name of the song.
Okay, well, here is just plain old "Fanfare."
Never this close. It's pulled, it won't let up. Gravity makes tides in me red in the waves of blood. Somehow I never thought I'd find my way back to you. Somehow I never thought I'd find my way back.
And on their website, they describe themselves as indie rock meets Django Reinhardt gypsy jazz. What do you hear that you like?
Well, I actually hear that, and the story about that is that the main singer in the band was in a band, local band here in Los Angeles, called Oliver Future, and when that band dissolved, he decided to teach himself Django Reinhardt gypsy guitar by himself. So he dedicated a whole bunch of time to this. He then got his brother to join the band, and he brought that to the pop music that he's always been known for here in L.A.
Well, let's get to another artist who is nowhere near L.A., Miro Wagner, born in Ethiopia, raised in Finland. Here is her song, "What Love Looks Like."
Through thick and thin, that's what they say. Forgive and forget. Well, it's me that has to change. Is this what love looks like? Is this what love looks like?
I almost feel like I'm listening to a Johnny Cash song, sung by a woman.
interesting. Well, you know, she's got that darkness that Johnny Cash often brought to his music. And she's acoustic, fully acoustic singer. And this folk music, it's not go to Starbucks music. It's not coffee house music. It's actually much more complicated than that. It's very precise and it's very brave in a way that a lot of acoustic music sometimes isn't. And that's what I love about her.
Now I'm spitting bitter teeth. Through thick and thin, that's what they say. Forgive and forget. Well, it's me that has to change. Is this what love?
All right, well, I will say on reflection that some of these songs don't scream summer to me, Anne, but the good news is for anybody who heard the promotion that we've been running for this segment, there is one that really does, and this is Cinquain, and he lives here in the U.S., but he's from Africa. Here is the song Moonstruck.
Each night outside.
Now I'm ready to go to the beach.
finally, after that set of sad summer songs. I stumbled upon Cinquain 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago at South by Southwest. And my favorite nights at South by Southwest are when I strike out on my own and I just sort of stumble around town and try to find things. And I found Cinquain playing in a backyard with a keyboard and like one other guy. And I was completely blown away. I ended up talking to him a bunch after he finished playing and learned that he was originally from Sudan, raised in Ohio, now lives in Brooklyn, multi-instrumentalist. His name is Ahmed Galab. And he's incredible.
And of course, you can listen to these songs all year long because you're in Los Angeles, which is totally unfair.
You're exactly right, and I plan to take full advantage of that.
And let DJ at KCRW, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you can hear all of our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. Enjoy the last few days of summer. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.